Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This podcast is on Sukkot. Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Sukkot, the Sukkah. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member at Pardes and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. Today we will be examining the festival of Sukkot, and in particular, looking at the mitzvah of Sukkah. There are three places in the Torah where we discuss the festival of Sukkot. Leviticus chapter 23, Numbers chapter 29, and Deuteronomy chapter 16. In Numbers chapter 29, Sukkot is examined through the lenses of the temple. We discuss all of the special offerings that are brought on Sukkot. That is not what I would like to focus on today. Instead, I would like to look at Leviticus and Deuteronomy. In both sections, Sukkot is presented as part of the cycle of festivals. And in both sections, the emphasis is placed on the agricultural component of Sukkot. In Leviticus chapter 23, verse 39, "But on the 15th day of the seventh month, when you gather the produce, the grains of the land, you shall celebrate a festival of God for 7 days. On the first day, there shall be a cessation of work, and on the eighth day, there shall be a cessation." Sukkot is the harvest festival. That idea is echoed in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 13. "The festival of Sukkot you shall make to you for 7 days, when you gather in your granaries and in your vats." If we examine the agricultural cycle of the year in the land of Israel, we note the fact that Pesach is the beginning of the harvest season, and the first thing to be harvested is the barley. We then continue in the period between Pesach and Shavuot and begin the harvesting of the wheat, and also of the seven species which the land of Israel is noted for. And the harvest of the wheat and the seven species continues throughout the summer, culminating in the festival of Sukkot. For those of us who live in the land of Israel, we know that in fact, the period of Sukkot is not only the end of the wheat harvest, but the period of Sukkot is also the end of the grape season. It is the time when we harvest pomegranates. It is the time when we harvest figs. This agricultural perspective also gives us a handle on a very interesting textual observation that we have in Deuteronomy chapter 16. When the Torah discusses the festival, there is no mention of rejoicing. When the Torah discusses the festival of Pesach, there is no mention of rejoicing. When we move on and discuss the festival of Shavuot, we mention rejoicing once. This is in chapter 16, verse 11. "And you will rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son and your daughter and your servant and your maid and the Levite that is in your gate, and the stranger and the orphan and the widow that is in your midst, in the place which God has chosen to cause his name to dwell." When we come to Sukkot, we mention rejoicing twice. In verse 14, "And you shall rejoice in your festival, you and your son and your daughter, etc." And then again in verse 15. 7 days you shall celebrate to the Lord your God in the place that he has chosen. When he blesses you in all of your produce and in all of the work of your hands, you shall be only joyous. We have a progression. The festival of Pesach, no rejoicing. The festival of Shavuot, we begin to rejoice. And the festival of Sukkot, not only do we emphasize rejoicing, but we say in a very declarative manner, you shall be only joyous. The ability to celebrate, the ability to be rejoicing, is very much connected with the tangible blessing which we experience. Pesach is the very beginning of the harvest season. And in fact, what's harvested is the barley. And according to the rabbinic understanding, barley is generally what was used for animal food. It is only on Sukkot that we begin to appreciate the work of our hands and to be able to be happy with what we have. That is when we are beginning and perhaps even going into high gear with the wheat harvest. Sukkot is when we are able to now sit back and to value and appreciate all of what the land has to offer us. And when we are showered with all that abundance, as the Torah says, we should be happy. This theme of happiness being connected with physical prosperity, we also have noted in another podcast, when the Torah discusses the Bikurim, the first fruits, in Deuteronomy chapter 26, it says that when you come into the land of Israel and you're settled there, you should make sure to bring the first fruits to the temple in Jerusalem. There is a whole ceremony, a whole procedure of bringing the first fruits, which includes a declaration recalling how we were once slaves in Egypt. And now that God has brought us into the land of Israel and given us all these fruits. And after one brings the first fruits, the very last verse of that section, which is chapter 26, verse 11, it says, you shall rejoice in all the good which God has given you, to you and to your home, you and the Levite and the stranger in your midst. Which means that as we are blessed with physical prosperity, it is extremely important that we should, on the one hand, show our thanks to God, bring those first fruits to the temple, acknowledge where they came from, and as a result of that, that we should then be happy with what we have. Sukkot, which is happening at the end of the agricultural cycle, where we have gathered all of our produce, that is the time for us to then be grateful and thankful to God, and to show that thanks by rejoicing in our festival. For this reason, in our tefillot, in our prayers, in the Amidah of Sukkot, in the Birkat HaMazon that we say, grace after meals, we refer to Sukkot as Zman Simchatenu, the time of our rejoicing, because this is the time when we in fact experience the bounty of God. There is another reason why Sukkot is Zman Simchatenu, and that is connected with the placing of Sukkot immediately after Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the day that God forgives us for our sins, the day that we have been given the opportunity to begin a new chapter, to once again enter into a relationship with God, that day should then lead to an outpouring of rejoicing. It's as if on Yom Kippur, we are renewing our vows, getting married once again to God. And then the period of Sukkot is like the 7-day period after the wedding, when we celebrate with God. And therefore, one could see that the month of Tishrei has a rhythm to it of going from fear, trembling, to rejoicing. We begin with Rosh Hashanah, which is the day of judgment. God is the king sitting on the throne. And that should create within us a sense of trepidation. We say in the prayers, who will live and who will die? And the whole movement from Rosh Hashanah to Sukkot is a movement from the fear of the day of judgment to the rejoicing of having been forgiven and once again being reunited with God and celebrating with God. With that as the background, I would like to now focus in particular on the mitzvah of Sukkah. There's a question that's actually raised by the commentaries as to why do we sit in a sukkah during this period. And the reason for that question is because it would be much more natural to sit in a sukkah during the summer, during the heat of the summer. And it would have made much more sense to say, celebrate Sukkot in the summertime. For some of us who live in North America, the chilly parts of North America, or for those who are living in various parts of Eastern Europe, it can actually become very, very cold on Sukkot. And it is not natural to sit in a sukkah. And hence there are rabbis who say that that's exactly why we sit in the sukkah at that time, as a way of showing that we're doing this not because this would be the normal thing to do, but we're doing this purely as a ceremonial act in service of God. In fact, if we go according to the agricultural dimension that I mentioned earlier, it is very natural, even to this day, in Arab cultures in the Middle East, that during the harvest season, in the summertime, that booths are built as guard posts where someone sits and stays for the whole duration of the summer in order to protect and watch over the fields so that no one will come and steal the produce. But by the time Sukkot comes around, you pack up your bags, pack up your booth, and leave. So that it is an anomaly that we actually sit in a sukkah at that very time, as a way of showing that we're not doing this because this would be the natural thing to do, but we're doing this because God told us to, and in that way expressing our service of God. But I would like to examine this in much greater depth. So let us begin with a disagreement that appears in the Talmud among two well-known rabbis of the Mishnah, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva. And their disagreement hinges on a verse which appears in Leviticus chapter 23, which discusses the mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah. In chapter 23 of Leviticus, verse 42, it says, in the booths you shall sit, you shall settle for 7 days. All of the citizens of Israel shall settle down in their booths. And then the key verse, verse 43. In order that your generation shall know that in booths I made you sit, I made the Jewish people sit when I took them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. This verse is telling us that the reason that we sit in the booths is in order to commemorate the experience of the Jews who were traveling in the desert, to remember the booths which God placed them in as they go on their journeys. And once again, I would like to mention, if this is commemorating the travels of the Jews in the desert, it would have made a lot of sense to sit in the booths at a time when they are really vital in the desert, in the heat of the summer. What were those booths? Here is where we come to the disagreement between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Eliezer says that the booths were actually the clouds of glory. And Rabbi Akiva says, no, they were, as they literally mean, booths. The commentaries fully understand the position of Rabbi Eliezer. We know that when the Jewish people traveled in the desert, we're told already in Exodus, in chapter 14, there is a cloud which goes before them during the day, which leads them through the desert. And that point is reiterated later on in the book of Numbers, in chapter 9, describing how throughout the 40 years that the Jews were wandering in the desert, there was always the cloud that led them. And the rabbis embellish this idea of the cloud and say that there wasn't just one cloud. There were clouds on all sides of the Jewish people, on top, around, below. These are the clouds of glory. These are the clouds that reflected the protection of God. The clouds that protect them from all the elements, from the heat, from the cold. The clouds that level the obstacles in their path. Any sand dunes are leveled. The clouds that make sure that there are no snakes and scorpions that can harm them. These are the clouds that reflect a supernatural intervention by God to take care of the Jewish people. And so the commentaries say, if when we go and sit in the sukkah, we are now supposed to be recalling this supernatural act of God, it is fully understandable. And in fact, one could see that this is how the festival of Sukkot, and in particular the mitzvah of Sukkah, rounds out the cycle of festivals. If on Pesach we tell the story of the miraculous deliverance of the Jewish people from Egypt, the 10 plagues, the crossing of the Red Sea, on Sukkot we talk of the miraculous sustaining of the Jewish people during their wandering in the desert. But what about the other position, Rabbi Akiva? Rabbi Akiva, who says that God had us dwell in simple booths in the desert. One could say, so what? Big deal. Why is it so important for us to remember this? In order to understand the position of Rabbi Akiva, it is worth looking at a section that we have looked at in other podcasts. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Let us begin with verse 2. God says, and you should remember the path which God led you for 40 years in the desert, in order that he afflict you, he test you, in order to know that which is in your heart. Will you observe the commandments or not? And in verse 3, he afflicted you, he starved you, he gave you to eat the manna which you didn't know and which your forefathers did not know, in order to make known to you that not on bread alone, or not by bread alone, does man live, but on that which comes out of the mouth of God does a man live. And in verse 4, your clothing did not get worn out, your feet did not become swollen for 40 years. And later on in that section, in verse 14, it comes back to this point, anticipating the Jewish people being in the land of Israel and expressing concern. And I'll skip the first two words for a moment of verse 14. The concern that perhaps you will forget the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, who led you in the desert, a great and terrifying desert, a place where snakes and scorpions are to be found, a place of thirst where there is no water, who brought forth to you water from the flint rock. In verse 16, who gave you manna to eat, food that your forefathers never knew, in order to afflict you, in order to test you, in order to ultimately do good for you. These verses are highlighting the experience of the Jews in the desert. They emphasize the fact that the desert was a terrifying place, a very threatening place, a place of scorpions, a place of snakes, a place of thirst, a place of scorching heat, very cold evenings. How did the Jewish people survive that experience? Because God provided for them. And what did God provide? God provided them with water. According to rabbinic tradition, the well of Miriam that accompanied them on all their travels. God provided them with the manna, supernatural food which became their bread substitute. And God also saw to it that their clothes did not wear out, their feet did not become swollen, snakes and scorpions did not attack them. And that was the result of the clouds of glory that we mentioned earlier. And why are they being told all that? Because the Torah is anticipating their entry into the land of Israel. And it says, when you will come into the land, and you will become extremely affluent, you will have beautiful homes, and you will have silver and gold and cattle and sheep and everything that you could possibly want. The Torah is very concerned, and now I come back to the first two words of verse 14. You will become elevated in your heart. The Torah is very concerned with what it says in verse 17, that you will say in your heart, it is the power and the strength of my hand that have accumulated all of this wealth. And therefore the Torah says in verse 18, don't say that. Remember, it is the Lord your God who is the one who gives you the strength in order to produce all of that wealth. Which means that the Torah is very concerned that as we become affluent, as we become successful, there is the very real fear that this will go to our heads. There is the very real fear that we will ascribe all of our success to ourselves. And therefore the Torah says, remember the desert. Remember what it was like when you had nothing and God provided you with whatever you needed to be able to survive. And the same God who provided for you in the desert is the God who has now provided for you and empowered you to accumulate all of this wealth and affluence. So therefore, let me now go back to Rabbi Akiva. If in fact the Sukkot which God provided for the people in the desert were literally booths, in the same way that God provided for the people water and manna, God also provided booths. God provided the people with the basics, the simple things of life. And what God showed the Jewish people as they wandered through the desert is that that's all they needed. That they could not only survive, but even thrive with all of these basic elements. Hence, when we sit in the Sukkah, according to Rabbi Akiva, the idea of the Sukkah is to be a humbling experience. If I go back to what I mentioned at the beginning of the session, Sukkot is happening at the end of the harvest season. After the person has now seen the full bounty of their efforts, there is the very real concern that at that moment, this could lead to tremendous hubris, to the feeling of, it is me who has created all of this. And therefore the Torah says, leave your home, leave your castle, leave that place that gives you that feeling of empowerment. Go out in a booth, go back to basics. Remember what it was like in the desert. And as a result of that, put in perspective everything that you have. realize that everything that you have is given to you by God. It's not you. That is one idea of the sukkah. And if I could just connect that with what I mentioned earlier, by leaving my sukkah, by leaving my home, by going into a sukkah, perhaps that can also open me up more to sharing what I have with the Levite and the stranger and the orphan and the widow, to not lock the doors of my house and just keep everything for myself, but to go out, to reach out, to provide for all those who don't have. But there's another idea to the sukkah, and that may be connected with the clouds of glory. And that may be connected also to the juxtaposition of Sukkot to Yom Kippur. I mentioned earlier, Yom Kippur is the day of forgiveness. Yom Kippur is where we become reconnected to God. In the Torah, we are never told why that day is the day that is the day of forgiveness. What's so special about that day? There is a rabbinic tradition based on a variety of calculations that Yom Kippur was the day when God forgave the Jewish people completely for the sin of the golden calf. And it was on that day that Moses came down from the mountain and brought the second tablets, which were the symbol of the covenant, of a covenant that was intact. If one looks at the sections in the Torah that immediately follow the golden calf, from chapter 35 onwards, we are told of the whole process of the construction of the tabernacle. And in fact, according to rabbinic tradition, immediately after Yom Kippur, the Jews began the process of gathering all the materials, assembling them, in order to eventually build the tabernacle, which began functioning almost a half year later in the beginning, the first day of the month of Nisan. Why the juxtaposition between Yom Kippur and the construction of the tabernacle? In another podcast, we have discussed that a major theme of the tabernacle, of the temple, is to be a place where God will dwell in the midst of the Jewish people. If we see the covenant and the tablets of the covenant as being analogous to a couple that is betrothed and married, then we can see the tabernacle as being analogous to a couple that live together. And this is the idea that we have, that immediately in the aftermath of Yom Kippur, not only has God forgiven the Jewish people, not only have they been bonded together, but they will actually now dwell together through the tabernacle. And I think it's pretty obvious where I'm going. The sukkah is like a tabernacle. There are actually very interesting parallels. The reason that the sukkah is called the sukkah is because of the schach, the roof which protects, which gives shade. The tabernacle is called a mishkan, but in fact the mishkan is the name of the roof. The tabernacle has another name, which is the ohel, which was another layer of tapestry that served as a roof. In both cases, the buildings are defined by their roofs. In Kabbalistic, Hasidic literature, the tabernacle is seen or called Tzilta de Mehemnuta, the shadow of the faithful one. The idea being that when we sit in the sukkah is called that. When we sit in the sukkah, we are sitting in the shadow of God. The clouds of glory reflected the presence of God. When the tabernacle is established, the cloud fills the tabernacle. When the temple was constructed in the time of Solomon, the cloud filled the temple. From this perspective, rather than seeing the sukkah as being a humbling experience, The sukkah, in fact, is an empowering experience. The sukkah is what says, I now have this I-vow relationship with God in this sacred space. So that here we have two ideas of sukkah. One which is to humble the individual, make sure that they put in perspective that whatever they have is from God. Remember that experience they had wandering through the desert. Go back to basics. And another one is perhaps to remember the tabernacle that was constructed right after Yom Kippur. Remember how we need, after Yom Kippur, to build a place for God where we can have that ongoing I-vow encounter. Since I mentioned before the analogy of a wedding, think of the following analogy. In the same way that when a couple gets married, 7 days after the wedding, they have what's called Sheva Brachot, 7 days of celebration. And once upon a time in the period of the Talmud, they would actually construct a booth where the Sheva Brachot would take place. A temporary dwelling where the husband and wife would live and would celebrate for 7 days. So too, after Yom Kippur, when we renew our vows with God, we spend 7 days living with God in our sukkah, celebrating with God. It is very important for us to realize that the mitzvah of sukkah should then reflect back into our day-to-day lives, and that we need to take the experience of the sukkah back into our homes so that, on the one hand, if for 7 days we somehow go back to basics, remember that ultimately everything that we have is a gift of God. Ultimately remember that we can not only survive but even thrive with the very basics that are provided for us. To learn to appreciate and value and be happy with all the extras that we have. To be able to say that, look at all of this. Thank God for what we have. But not only that. If the sukkah is to provide us with an intense I-vow encounter, to have 7 days of celebrating in the shadow of God, how do we bring that back to our homes? How do we make our homes a temple of God? What is the Holy of Holies of our home? In the temple, the Holy of Holies, there was only one thing there, the Ark which housed the tablets, the Ark which housed the Torah, the Word of God. What is the Holy of our homes? What is the focal piece? In some homes, it's the television set, the computer. Maybe it should be the books. Maybe it should be the holy books, our libraries. Maybe our Holy of Holies should be a sacred space where we study. Maybe our families should come together not only to have fun, but to have some sort of uplifting religious experience. Our table, according to the rabbinic understanding, is an altar. The table where we eat. Our table can be a place where we indulge, where we are just constantly stuffing ourselves. Or our table can be a place where we invite guests, where we invite the needy, where we sing zmirot, where we say words of Torah. Our table can be a table of life that sustains and promotes life, meaningful life. I am doing this podcast 2 days before Yom Kippur. I would like to take the opportunity to wish everyone a Gmar Chatima Tova. May we be inscribed in the Book of Life. May God bless us with good health, prosperity, joy, fulfillment. May we find a way to move from the experience of Yom Kippur to Sukkot, to truly be happy with all that we have, to be able to learn how to make our homes a temple of God, to bring God into every aspect of our lives. And as I mentioned earlier in the session, may Sukkot be something, a period of where we are only happy, and may that happiness extend beyond Sukkot for the rest of our lives. Gemar chatima tova v'chag sameach.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Chag Sameach, and we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.